This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
The Supreme Court of the State has held that the role of the Honorable Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is in the matter of the adoption of AMRW, appeal number 31175. Having problems with the door?
Coming.
Arguing on behalf of the appellants, Shasta and Kelsey Weston, is Robert Trzynska. And Cynthia Arndt is arguing on behalf of appellee Megan Weston. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Trzynska, you will have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
May it please the court. Adoption is a creation of statute. It is unlike some other statute. It is not a creation of codifying what is underlying constitutional rights or other sort of fundamental rights. It is a creation of the legislature, and it is the function of the legislature to create the rules about how adoptions shall proceed. This is a case regarding adoption and what those statutory requirements are. I am here appearing on behalf of the appellants Shasta and Kelsey Weston, and there is no dispute that Shasta is the biological parent of AMRW 5. There are four others, children, that were not subject to this appeal because they were able to be adopted by Shasta and Kelsey. The appellee only chose to object to or demand notice of the adoption of the fifth child.
What was the difference with the other four children? Was it that they were born outside of the marriage?
What was it? That was never determined by the trial court, and that was never something that was ever at issue. We don't actually, to this date, know why she chose to want to adopt one but not the other four. But that is a factor that is present here, in that only one of the five children that were at issue in these adoption proceedings were subject to some sort of objection by the appellee in this case. The law in adoption is fairly straightforward. There is no underlying notice requirement, with the exception of notice to the Department of Social Services. There is no notice requirement to grandparents, or no notice requirement to any individuals other than the quote-unquote parents of the child.
So the parents have to consent, or there's a few exceptions for involuntary adoptions or dispensing with that requirement. Those don't seem to apply here.
That is correct.
So we're going under the rule that a parent needs to consent, and we're here in this appeal from what order?
Well, we are here from the, so there was an underlying order granting the adoption. There was then an emailed objection to that order. Without sufficient hearing, that order was summarily reversed. There was then a motion to reinstate the adoption, which was then a follow-up hearing. There was an order then denying that motion to reinstate the adoption, based on the notion that the appellee's consent needed to be obtained.
So, and that hasn't happened?
That has not happened.
It may not happen, I understand that, if I'm seeing things correctly, but the petition itself for adoption has not been denied.
Well, by function it has been denied, insofar as the original petition was granted, it was then reversed.
And so wouldn't that then set you back? And even the court talked about this. He said, well, look, I mean, I'm just saying you have to give notice in this case. You can have another petition, this one, you know, with notice. And I know you disagree with that, but wouldn't that then have reset the proceedings to an earlier point in time, and then they could run their course and things could play out? Let's say consent withheld, petition denied. Seems like then and only then we have a final order, but it doesn't seem like we've really gotten to that point. It seems like we may not have a final order.
Well, and that is certainly an issue that could be for consideration, but I think the prominent issue regarding that is, first, there was a final order granting the adoption. That was then reversed, much like a 60B motion. Then there was a follow-up motion to reinstate, which would be the equivalent of a motion for new trial, and then the appeal is from the denial of the motion to reinstate.
Understand all that. But it reset the parties to an earlier point procedurally, and they never finished the adoption proceeding.
Well, and this is where I think this is a unique sort of distinction, in that, you know, much like when we have a motion for new trial or that, I mean, I think it's the functional equivalent of a final order, insofar as there was a final order that was reversed. We're saying that that should have been the proper order.
Final order definition usually is it ends the litigation. There's nothing more to do. And you're right, it could be more functional than formal, and we have the ability to see the order that's being appealed, or the judgment that's being appealed, for its substance, not merely its form. I kind of agree with all of that. I think we've said that a number of times. But if you apply that definition, which we've used a number of times, there is more to be done. It doesn't end the litigation. I understand that it was ended at one point, but then it wasn't. And we all understand that. So this litigation, to me, looks as though it hasn't ended.
And this is where I think maybe our disagreement is on this issue, Justice Salter, is that, you know, this, the position and the reason why I believe that this was ripe for consideration by this court is that it should have been a final order, but we're drugged back into the proceedings against what should have been an underlying final order. And so I think it was error from the standpoint of a final order that we are continuing to litigate this issue.
What do you make of, I don't know if it's an inconsistency, but maybe there's an inherent inconsistency with the judge's order denying your petition for reinstatement of the adoption, holding that Megan is a parent, but then at the same time refusing to sign findings of facts, conclusions of law, which state the same thing. And then I compare that to the judge's statement at oral, at the conclusion of the oral argument in front of him, where he says, "Well, now you just get to do this over again. Now everybody has noticed. Let's go." How do you square all these three?
Well, that is where we struggled with, is that there were a number of inconsistencies, and I think in particular the inconsistency that we had our biggest concern with was. And with all due respect to Judge Pekus, when he unilaterally decided that he could disregard the legal and factual conclusions of the divorce court that Megan was not a quote-unquote parent of... I think that is probably one of the real... ...of this case, is that there are these inherent underlying procedural inconsistencies that were erroneous and point out the error of the... of the number one, the reversal of the underlying adoption, and then number two, the refusal to reinstate it.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about this separate proceeding, this Temmie's Law proceeding that had happened previously. In your view, does the adoption in any way impact Megan's custody rights that she was afforded under Temmie's Law under 2559?
From my review of the underlying adoption rules is that if there is a custody arrangement in place regarding the parents of who are in the adoption, those would be affected. But because Megan is not a parent under the adoption rules, the custody order would not be necessarily impacted. I don't think.
So let me ask it maybe this another way. Do you think Temmie's Law, the custody rights afforded under that, could be subject to modification based on the adoption and the change in circumstances.
Absolutely. Certainly would create
So then let me ask you about this. The court's issue in this case appears to have been the trial court's issue was notice. And I know, and I'll acknowledge, chapter 25.6 doesn't seem to address notice, but I'm looking at 25.529, and it says, except for proceedings under 26.7A, 8A, 8B, 8C, those are the Chen's delinquency and abuse neglect statutes or chapters. It doesn't include adoptions in there, so does not list adoptions, except for proceedings under this chapter, not including adoptions. The court may allow any person other than the parent of a child to intervene or petition a court for custody and visitation. So this statute seems to add another facet to the adoption statutes that maybe the legislature contemplated. If you're going to be able to intervene, you need to have notice. And there was no notice, and so how can you intervene in an adoption if you don't even know what's going on?
Well, and if the legislature had intended that there was some sort of notice requirement, the legislature had the ability to put that in there. I don't think it's necessarily, and as this court has said repeatedly, it's not this court's responsibility to infer notice requirements or to infer procedural requirements if it is the creation of the legislature, which is sort of how we got to Tinney's Law in the first place, because we had the underlying issues in the Meldrum decision, which then prompted the legislature to pass 25.529, which was then subject to another appeal in the second Meldrum.
So let's grant you that. Let's say the legislature didn't create a notice right. Now she knows. Does she have a right to intervene in this proceeding, which isn't finished, under 25.529, which says a non-parent may intervene or petition a court for custody and visitation? So it seems like you have both an intervention, in other words, they're an interested party. They also have a right to petition for custody or visitation. And could they not do that in the adoption proceeding as well as any other proceeding, since there's nothing in the statute that says it doesn't apply to adoptions?
Well, and with all due respect, Chief Justice, I think you sort of highlighted the distinction that's important here, in that 25.529 specifically gives a right to intervention on, quote, custody or visitation, unquote. It doesn't give a right to intervene in underlying adoptions. Certainly, there's a subsequent, or there could be follow-up proceedings regarding custody and visitation that are then prompted by the underlying adoption, but that doesn't, by the plain language of the statute, doesn't give a right of intervention in the underlying adoption proceedings.
Well, but that's not what the statute says. The statute says a non-parent may intervene because they're an interested party, or petition for custody or visitation. In other words, it's disjunctive. It's not, you have to petition for custody and visitation. You can just intervene because you're an interested party.
Well, but what is the creation of them as an interested party is only created by virtue of the underlying petition to intervene. You know, they aren't an interested party. The individual who's obtaining custody and visitation rights under 25.529, they aren't an underlying interested party until they file the petition for custody or visitation, and that then makes them an interested party in the custody and visitation action. That doesn't make them an interested party in other ancillary actions, which aren't like an adoption proceeding. And if the legislature had intended them to create that ability to intervene in those proceedings, they would have added it to the laundry list of cases at the beginning of the statute.
So there's also a provision in 25.589. So these are the petitions for voluntary termination of parental rights, which has language that says the court may require notice to be served upon any other person after listing the parents or their specifics. So that also seems to allow the court to at least require notice when you're talking about the termination. And I know that's not an issue here. And then I've always, frankly, had some, challenge meshing those two chapters together and how their provisions work. But in many occasions, you start with the termination of parental rights before you end up with adoption. I acknowledge it's not an issue here, but we're just kind of trying to get our hands wrapped around of, is there an issue with the requirement of notice? Because the party may have an interest, even if they aren't the party that can hold it up without giving consent in the proceeding itself.
And I absolutely understand the concern, and there are, I do agree that there are concerns with the interplay of the underlying statutes. And in particular, I think when we're talking about the termination statutes, the reason why, part of the reason why you have the really stiff requirements for notice is because the underlying constitutional protections afforded to natural parents that this court has recognized and the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized. But there's a distinction between natural parents, step-parents, and then third parties who are able to have custody and visitation rights under Timmy's law.
I want to go back to Justice Salter's original question, though. So the circuit judge decides that you have to give notice to Megan, and is there anything that would preclude you in the existing action from going back, giving notice, and having a hearing, letting the judge decide it, and then bringing that up in front of us and asking us to resolve the same issue?
Certainly, we could have done that, Justice Myron. I think that
why is that a final order if you have other resolutions available to you?
Well, and the reason why is, and I think because it's the underlying continuation of the denial of the final order, and so part of the concern that we have here is it also sets a bad precedent in that if we have an underlying final order, the court erroneously reverses the underlying final order and says we need to have more proceedings, then we can drag on those proceedings ad infinitum.
But the judge said, I got it wrong because I didn't realize that you didn't give notice, and so I'm reversing that final order. Judges can always change their mind to make things happen the way they're supposed to happen. Am I not correct?
Well, and that's...
So it's not a final order when the judge changes it from a final order.
But the reversal of a final order, I believe, is still subject to this court's review under the final order rule.
So your light went red. I think Shirley is time up, the initial time.
Yeah, but also
we can't see the number.
Yeah, the number. Yeah,
it
went green and then it went red and it's back to green again.
Yeah.
So you're.
I guess the machine just wants me to talk forever ad infinitum, as I was just describing.
Yeah. So if you want to wrap.
Yeah, certainly. And the long story short of this is, you know, these are an issue of statutory creation. If the legislature intended to include a notice requirement to individuals under Timmy's law, they would have done so, or they could have done so, and it's not the point of this court to intervene. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arndt, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Cynthia Arndt, and I'm here on behalf of Megan Weston. This is a case, and the justices are spot on. This is a case about notice. And this is a case where Megan Weston was not afforded the opportunity of notice. She should have been given notice. That's absolutely correct.
Under what theory should she have received notice? As a parent? As a beneficiary of Timmy's law rights, under what status would entitle her to notice?
Actually, sir, both of those. And I'll assert to you the most telling thing about this entire case is on the settled record on page 169. And I say to you, this comes from the appellant's office. If we were saying she's a parent, then we would have to get her consent. And she's not going to give her consent, and that's a problem. And that, to me, is the worst thing that could be said here, because you are denying someone the opportunity to have an opportunity to give notice, to come forward, to say what you think, have people ask questions, and then go forward. That's the fundamental principles of due process.
Hang on. She surely had all kinds of opportunities in the underlying divorce action to litigate her parentage, and that was in fact litigated. And Judge Sons, who is not prone to, you know, a lot of adjectives, said this has been a tough case, contentious, bitter, all those sorts of things. And this is one of the issues that he sorted through. So it seems to me that this was litigated, and we have very compelling, very important institutional rules that prevent relitigation down the line when parties have had opportunities, as you say, to litigate these precise issues. So how is it that we skip over what happened in front of the divorce court?
Well, we don't step over that. Megan is a parent. Megan's always been a parent. Megan takes care of these children. Under extraordinary circumstances, Judge Song gave her joint legal and parent shared parenting rights. She continues to pay child support. She continues to pay for their health insurance. She has them on a week on
week. But Timmy's law allows non-parents to do this very thing that you're just talking about. Judge Song specifically held, I mean, unambiguously in my opinion, that Megan is not a parent. And then he turned to Timmy's law to determine what her custody and visitation rights would be. Why should we disregard that?
I would suggest to you that we don't disregard it, but that's a reason she's entitled to notice.
So she did. I may or may not agree with you, but this case started out without notice. Ultimately, the judge, you know, was notified that there was an irregularity here. He reversed himself. Everybody had notice, and then the res judicata issue came to the forefront. So everybody had notice. At this point, everybody has got notice. Why should we disregard what Judge Song ruled in the divorce case?
I don't think, Your Honor, with all due respect, we disregard that court or we disregard the court of Judge Pekus. What the point is here is Megan Weston didn't get a chance to respond. That's the point.
Respond to what?
To respond a backdoor chance to try to adopt away a child that she has known to be her own, a child born during the marriage. Justice, you asked a question of the appellant earlier about children 2, 3, and 4. Those were children born prior to Obergefell, and the well has been well poisoned. It is our position by Chasta, and that is in the settled record. So child number 5 was born during the marriage. That gives a great deal of credibility here, and we need to give deference to that.
So that sets up a rebuttable presumption of parenthood, which was the whole point of the proceeding in the divorce court, where Judge Song, really thorough findings of facts, conclusions of law, found that she was not a parent.
He said she was not a legal parent. But the point being, under Timmy's law, sir, I believe the words are, if there was ever a case for extraordinary circumstances, this is it.
But Timmy's law only applies to non-parents, so am I wrong about that?
Well, sir, that child knows her to be a parent. Okay. So we could split hairs and we could say, well, she's not. But then how do you look at a little boy who's 9 years old and say, I've known this person to be a parent my entire life? And under the best interests of the child, you're going to rip that mother from that child?
So what legal rule, though, are you talking about here? I mean, that is an emotional, sentimental argument that I understand what you're saying, but we have to make a decision based upon principles and rules. Timmy's law, by its text, applies to non-parents. 2564 requires, by its text, the consent of parents. Are there other parents besides legal parents that 2564 could apply to? If it's a parentage that you're talking about in a more colloquial sense, okay, I understand that, but that has to be connected to rules, principles, before we can really rule in your favor, right?
The principle of substantial fairness, due process, fair dealing, that's a fundamental principle. Megan has played a part in this child's life. I believe this court in previous questioning was right when it said they should have had notice. What I'm suggesting is maybe what you folks suggested earlier, as this case was not fully developed in the lower court and they perhaps appealed here and jumped the gun and did it too soon. If we have to fetter it out, send it back down, and we can have an argument and fully develop that record.
So assume for a moment that Megan's not a parent. Is she entitled to notice under any other provision in the code or any other source?
Yes, sir. I would assert to you she is. She's entitled because she has been a part of this child's life, and the statute earlier quoted by the court is that anybody that's an interested party should be entitled to notice. The problem I have, if we agree with the Shasta court, with Shasta's idea, where do we end? We tell the general public that it's okay to not tell anybody you're going to do something just to get your own way. She didn't like the way John Song ruled, so within a couple months, she went to Sisseton Oyate. They threw it out. Then, within a few months more, a few steps down the hall from Judge Song, she goes to Judge Pekus and does it again. All of those things, we are sending the wrong message to the general public. It's okay to not tell the truth. It's okay to get your own way.
Can I ask you about, I want to understand something a little bit better. You said, if I understood you correctly, and if I didn't, please correct me, you said that the issue of res judicata or issue preclusion is not ripe. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, if you look at the appellant's brief, they talk about it's not ripe for appeal. The court has not fully considered the effect of Megan's involvement in the child's life with Timmy's law and notice and adoption. I think that's a fully developed record that needs to happen before this court can fully decide that.
Which court is in better position to evaluate that? The court that sits on the adoption case or the divorce court that governs custody, visitation, and so on?
The divorce court spent several days working on this. The divorce court spent several hours writing their findings and conclusions. That needs to be given credence and some merit. Then the problem we have with this adoption proceeding is it was done backdoored. Not only once, sir, but twice.
I understand all of that, but here we are. Everybody's got notice. The issue of parentage was litigated in front of Judge Pekus, and you argued that the issue of res judicata or issue preclusion is not ripe, and Judge Pekus refused to give any credence to Judge Son's order. So I'm trying to understand where you're coming from you're saying it's not ripe.
When I say Judge Pekus made a ruling, and perhaps I'm not understanding your comment.
I'm sorry.
That's entirely possibly. But my position here is Judge Song took his time and made a ruling. He listened to the people. He listened to the evidence. He listened to several experts, and he concluded, if there ever was a case, to give her parenting rights of joint legal and shared parenting. That, to me, she is a parent. She may not be a biological parent, sir, in all due respect, but she was a child. This child was a child born during a marriage, and if anybody knew who
actually
was...
actually not any kind of parent.
Pardon me?
The text says that Timmy's law is for non-parents. And if you... I mean, you can say she's a parent, but that's just you saying it. Timmy's law specifically exempts it. I mean, that's the text of the statute. I mean, we didn't make that up. That's what the statute says. So it only applies to non-parents. So someone who prevails under Timmy's law does not become a parent. If we were to hold that, then I think we would have maybe probably some issues. We're bound by the text. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that she's a parent. In fact, it says the opposite. It says that anyone who gets those rights is restricted to the class of people who are non-parents.
And if we look at that and we make strict rules, looking just at that and give this a very narrow interpretation, we fly in the face of the best interest of that child. And that is another consideration I think this court has to make. I think this court does need to make that.
But wouldn't the best interest of the child then be determined by the divorce court?
It was. That's why they have shared parenting.
But the adoption wouldn't have necessarily changed the custody arrangement.
Well, it did, actually, sir, with all due respect.
Oh, it did?
In this
situation. Where's that in the record?
Yes, it is in the record, if I may explain.
Sure.
Thank you. In this case, Megan pays child support. Megan does all the things a parent would do. If you look carefully in our brief, and before Judge Pekas, when they first granted the adoption, all of a sudden the Sioux Falls School District got notice that Megan wasn't a parent, she was a guardian. She's still paying the bill, but she doesn't have any rights, and that's wrong. That's completely wrong. That is so unbelievably backdoor and no notice and no help and nothing.
What rule, that's wrong.
What
rule says that it's wrong? What rule is it? What statute, what case, what rule says that's
You know,
that's
Your
wrong?
Honor, with all due respect, I believe public policy says that.
I'm not sure we make public policy.
Pardon me?
I'm not sure we make public policy. That may be something for the branch of government upstairs.
But we can certainly interpret it and look at it, and I think we need to. I think we need to look at that. We cannot be so narrow that we look at this like this. We cannot do that because there's so many more things that are fettered here. I suspect we may be here today on notice. We may have to go back and develop a record, and I may see you again next year if you permit me to come and talk to you. But that is the situation we are dealing with. In conclusion, the appellant's intentional lack of notice denied Megan the opportunity to contest the adoption not only once but twice. This case is about notice. This case is about due process and about standing, and it's also about fair dealing. And it's also about a child, and a child who knows two moms. She could know stepmoms as well, but he knows two moms. And he deserves to continue to have these two moms that both have rights and say of how he can be raised. And that remains also a consideration, and we need to give consideration to that in the best interest of the child. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Trzinka, you may proceed.
I'll put my laptop here so that I can see the screen.
I'm just going to jump in with your limited time. So, you know, we're talking about whether notice was proper, whether this is a final order, but, you know, there's so many pieces that come together in terms of how this would ultimately play out. So, if the court implicitly found she's not a, or that she is a parent, I'm sorry, Judge Pekas, and that's why notice was required. If the court were to then determine that because of the circumstances here, she's not a parent, that would have to consent in order to grant an adoption. Can an adoption still be denied by the court even if her consent isn't needed because of these other circumstances?
I don't believe under the existing rules under 25-6 that the trial court can. The rules, specifically under 25-6-4, require the consent of the parents. There's no, as...
Well, I'm not talking about what's required. I'm saying, so if the court says, well, you know, you're right, under this definition of a parent, her consent is not required, could the adoption still be denied, even if her consent isn't required because of these other circumstances that we have here, another person with legal custody, and that may be impacted by an adoption or something of that nature?
I don't think under the wording of the existing laws that the trial court had the discretion to deny it if the consent of both parents is provided.
So, the reason I'm asking that is it might play into the whole, is there more to be done here? Or in your position, is the court, I think, is effectively determined that she's a parent that requires notice?
And I think that was really the crux, and sometimes we don't say things as artfully as we would like, but I think that's the crux of it, is that the denial of the motion to reinstate was based on the erroneous interpretation that that Megan was a parent.
Let me ask you this. I had another question, but it was the opposite one. Could you still win? if this wasn't final or you hadn't taken the appeal but you did have to give notice, could you still, at the critical point that the adoption hearing, could you still win? Could you press your argument that, hey, judge, look, I know you ordered evidence, I know you ordered notice on this. We think that was erroneous, but in any event, it's been done. Everybody's here. And, you know, here's our argument that this is done and dusted because it was decided by Judge Song, and this isn't apparent, so we should win. Could that happen? And then the judge says, yeah, maybe that was improvident, but, you know, she's not a legal parent. That's what Judge Song held.
So, certainly it's a possibility, but there's a million different possibilities, and I think what's concerning here specifically was Judge Pekus's note that he wasn't bound by what Judge Song ruled. And I think that's why we need to have direction from this court as to who are the actual legal parents, which is required under 2564, to give consent to this. And I think there's no dispute that the only people under the statutes as they are written today that whose consent is required are the parents. And that,
but we haven't gotten to that point yet. We haven't gotten to the point where there's an official. And I understand that may be not too far off in the offing, and maybe it's all over pervading this record that there's just not going to be consent. But we haven't gotten to the point where they had the hearing and would determine, one, is a parent, and then, two, she withholds consent, petition denied.
Well, with all due respect, when Judge Pekus denied the motion to reinstate based on the notion that Megan was a parent, that decision was made. And so I think from a matter of both a legal standpoint and a matter of judicial efficiency, sending this case back with specific instructions as to who is a parent for the purposes of an adoption is the best way to move forward.
And getting a denial on the record, a withholding of consent.
Correct.
So the court's determination that she required notice was dependent on the fact that she was listed on the birth certificate.
That's correct. Which
was the birth certificate identified or part of the divorce proceedings below? I mean, the court referred to the presumption that the child born during the marriage would have that presumption that started there and then found it was rebuttable, and here's how it was rebuttal. But was the birth certificate even at issue, or was that part of the divorce proceedings? If you know.
I see that I'm out of time, but if I can respond.
Answer it.
So I want to answer it in two different ways. Number one, whether every specific argument on an issue was presented at a court is, I think, to a certain extent irrelevant from the standpoint of res judicata. It's whether or not it could have been presented. Certainly the birth certificate issue could have been presented. And then the second way that I would answer it is that this court has already made that decision as black letter law in the Crowles v. Crowles decision from 96, I believe.
Well, that was applying another state's law. I don't know that we've ever addressed it under South Dakota laws relating to birth certificates.
Applying Iowa law and then looking at the same issue from the standpoint of equitable estoppel on the next section, which essentially is decided the same factual pattern. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.